One of the very first fights Governor Rauner picked when he came into office was with public unions.
These forced union dues are a critical cog in the corrupt bargain that is crushing taxpayers.
Now that fight is going all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Constitutional law scholar Vikram Amar joins us to explain more. Plus, with the growing need for nurses across Illinois, a new state law could help some nurses provide more kinds of care without needing to get approval from a doctor. And
Rizzo hits a little pop fly, shallow left center. Turner going out. That ball is going to be a base hit. Coming in to score is Martin. The Cubs take the lead. The Cubs take the lead.
That's last night on 670 The Score. And today, the Cubs can clinch the National League Division Series with a win. Are they on the road to their second straight World Series? We'll talk Cubs and other sports with WBEZ Chicago's Cheryl Ray Stout. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When he took office almost 3 years ago, one of Governor Rauner's first big battles with Democratic lawmakers was over public unions. With all that's gone on since then, especially when you think about our budget impasse, you might have forgotten about the issue of whether state employees should have to pay what's called a, quote, fair share fee to a union, even if they're not members. Child support specialist Mark Janis argued he shouldn't have to against the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Council 31, the largest public sector union in the state. And now that case has reached all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is back in session as of last week. It's the first term that includes Justice Neil Gorsuch, who was appointed to the bench by President Donald Trump to replace Justice Antonin Scalia. And the cases the high court will consider this term range from partisan gerrymandering to protection for whistleblowers to President Trump's travel ban. There's a lot to get into here. Joining me from our studios in Urbana is Vikram Amar, a constitutional law scholar who's also the dean of the University of Illinois College of Law. Vic, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you, Nyla.
Vic, people might not remember this union fight because it was years ago. How did this wind up all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, the Supreme Court has been interested in taking a case on this issue for several years. And in fact, they had one the year that Justice Scalia passed away. And because he did pass away, the court voted 4-4, deadlocked in that case. And the basic question here is whether someone who chooses not to be part of a public sector union, but who works for the public sector, has to pay something to the union to help defray the cost that the union incurs in the collective bargaining element of the union's job. So when unions collect dues, they use the money for many things. Sometimes they take the money and they make political contributions. They endorse political candidates and the like. And the Supreme Court held a long time ago that, at least as regards public sector unions, if you don't like the political activity of your union, you shouldn't have to pay money for that purpose. But the Supreme Court has also said, since the union does more than politic, it engages in collective bargaining to increase wages and benefits and pensions and all that, that individuals who choose not to be members of the union still have to give the union some money so they can undertake those economic activities, because otherwise you'd be a free rider. You'd get the benefit of the good bargain that the union struck, the higher wages, the higher benefits, but you wouldn't have to pay anything to the union to represent you on that stuff.
Right. So, and Vic, remind me again, the political money, that's set aside, right? Like, I thought that was the case you were referring to. Any political donations the unions make, it can't come from dues. Am I correct?
Well, it can come from dues, but the union has to give each person who is an employee the chance to opt out. So if you don't want your money to go toward political activities, then you have to tell the union that, and then they can't take that money from you for that purpose. But they can take other money for the collective bargaining purpose. What Governor Rauner and Mr. Janis and others argue is, even when a union is engaged in bargaining activities, there's a political dimension to that, because, you know, whether public sector employees should be paid more or what public unions, pensions should look like, those are all contested political issues that you can't easily separate the union's political activities from its collective bargaining activities, and that people who don't like the union should never be forced to give the union any money. And that's what this case is about, whether there's a First Amendment right to have to be free from paying the union anything when you don't necessarily agree with the union's positions. Now, of course, if people don't have to pay money to the union to collectively bargain, then, as I said earlier, people are going to be free riders. People are going to say, well, I'm not going to give money to the union, but I'll take advantage of the good deal that the union strikes on behalf of all employees, including me. And public sector unions would be arguably crippled if people don't have to pay this so-called agency or fair share fee you referred to earlier.
Mm-hmm, right. And of course, this is all against the context of looking at public sector unions and how much their position, not just membership, but has been weakened across the country. I'm thinking about Wisconsin. We're talking about this case that is going to be heard by the U.S. Supreme Court with Vic Amar. He's a constitutional law scholar. We have questions that we already got from folks about different cases this court is going to be hearing this term on Reddit. We're going to get to those in a minute. If you have other questions for Vic, you can tweet them to us. Our handle is 21STShow. If you want to give us a call, that number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-9455, or you can tweet to 21STShow. So, Vic, I guess the question is, now with this new court, now that we have Justice Gorsuch on the bench, those who are hoping for a union win, for an AFSCME win, are probably pretty concerned.
I think that's right. The smart betting is that the court will move in the direction of freeing public sector employees from having to pay money to the union, even for collective bargaining, which, as I said earlier, could damage the ability of public sector unions to operate at all, which is part of the larger trend you mentioned with declining membership. There is a possible middle ground. So I mentioned earlier that with regard to the political activities of a union, distinguished from the collective bargaining, that individuals have a right to opt out. The court could say, instead of giving people a right to opt out, the union, if it wants to collect any money at all, has to go with an opt-in procedure where you got to get the explicit permission of individuals before you collect money for political activities. Because there are a lot of people who may not like the political activities the union's engaged in, but they may not take the time to formally opt out of paying. So they end up paying, not realizing that their money is going to politics. So if the court is really worried about the politics element, it can just move from an opt-out to an opt-in regime. But if the court thinks that the collective bargaining activity is essentially political as well, then it will say the First Amendment protects people from having to give anything to the union, and that will really hurt unions' ability to operate going forward.
So, Vic, I know you're a constitutional law scholar, but I'm curious where labor law comes into this picture, right? Because the National Labor Relations Act protects the right to organize. There are sort of essential parts of the American law that say that unions should exist, that they should, that employees have a right to form a union, that that right should be protected, your job should not be in question if you try to form a union. There's all sorts of these other things on the books that sort of explain that and the right for unions. All of that, I think lots of labor folks would argue those protections have eroded over the past couple of decades. Where does the whole idea, though, of the notion of just a union itself being, if you think collective bargaining is a political act, where does that fall when you look at sort of the National Labor Relations Act and other laws that say that just having the right to the union is just an American right and it's not a political act?
You know, I think it's a very sophisticated question that you're asking, because there is a complicated interplay here between labor law and emerging First Amendment doctrine. I guess the answer technically is, to the extent that one reads the First Amendment as preventing the government from forcing individuals to pay money to a union for political activities with which they disagree. And remember, we're talking only here about public sector unions, not private sector unions, because the First Amendment limits the government's ability to coerce people. If you think the First Amendment forbids that, then the First Amendment is going to trump anything that Congress ever enacted in any federal labor law. And in the past 20 years, the First Amendment has really been read more and more expansively, especially by a lot of the conservative justices. And that's the kind of the consequences of that expansion that we're seeing in cases like this one.
And what do we know about Justice Gorsuch and his opinion on unions? Do we have any sense of what his past work or any kind of sense of where he stands on this? Where does the let's start with that before we look at the rest of the court.
I think judging from his opinions on the Tenth Circuit and from the confirmation hearings, there is reason to believe that he would side with the more conservative justices and agree with Justice Scalia, who before he died had taken the position that the First Amendment forbids compulsory payment of any fees to public sector unions. You know, when someone gets to the Supreme Court, all bets are off and he's free to rethink things. I think good judges do rethink things. So, you know, I never bet on Supreme Court cases, but if I had to make a prediction, I would say this is likely to be 5-4 against the union in favor of Mr. Janus. And the question is just how broadly the court rules in favor of the individual.
And then how would states respond like to a ruling like this? And because as you're pointing out, this is a case that originated here in Illinois, but then obviously would have nationwide implications.
That's true. Although it's not all states that require public sector employees to pay agency fees or fair share fees to public sector unions. I think it's fewer than half of the states that do that. But in all those states, like California, where last year's case came from, that was a case involving teachers in California, all those states would have to stop enforcing their laws that required such payments. That's what Governor Rauner tried to do when he took office. He tried to stop enforcing the Illinois law that required payments by individuals to the unions. And then the question really is, well, how are unions going to respond to get revenue in other ways to enable them to operate? Or perhaps they'll just be less effective in their collective bargaining activities. Or perhaps people won't be free riders. And even if they have the right not to pay, some of them will go ahead and pay anyway because they believe in the union's collective bargaining activity. So there's a lot of uncertainty, but all of it is kind of scary for the unions going forward if the court rules broadly here.
That's Vic Amar. He's a dean of the University of Illinois College of Law, a constitutional law scholar. We're talking about this new term of the U.S. Supreme Court, this one particular case involving unions that originated right here in Illinois that the court is scheduled to hear. We're not exactly sure when it will come up during this session. Obviously, this session goes through next summer, but it's on the docket for this term. If you have questions or comments for Vic, you can give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Oh, it looks like we've got Max from Urbana on the line. Hey, Max, you have a question about corporations giving money to political causes. Just a legal question, right?
Well, it seemed to me the same principle would apply to corporate political contributions. Why, if labor union people don't have to make contributions to things they don't agree with, why do corporate stockholders have their money given to political candidates they may oppose by the corporation, and the corporation doesn't even have to disclose it, if I understand United correctly?
Go ahead, Vic.
It's an interesting question, and I think you're right that at some level of generality, the issue is the same. Namely, we all end up having our money used for political purposes with which we may disagree. If we own stock in a corporation, for example, if we just pay taxes, the government speaks all the time, and we may not agree with this message that the government promotes, but that doesn't mean that we don't have to pay taxes to support the government's activities. But I think the key difference between the corporate setting and this union setting is, in the corporate setting, the government isn't forcing anybody to allow the corporation to do anything. The shareholders, if they want to, can amend the corporate charter and the bylaws to provide more disclosure or to eliminate political activities of the corporation, et cetera. Here, this is public sector unions, and there are state laws that require public employees to pay money to this entity. And the government's fingerprints aren't on the corporation setting in quite the same way.
Vic, can you remind us again for folks that of Citizens United comes up a lot? Can you just give us a quick refresher on that Supreme Court ruling, which really did change the landscape
sure,
in the way that we look at political contributions?
Well, It's interesting because Citizens United didn't involve political contributions. It involved political expenditures. So the law has been very clear for some time that corporations cannot contribute or donate money to political candidates. So if a corporation favored Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, they could not give money to the Clinton or Trump campaigns. But what Citizens United said is they can engage in independent campaign expenditures. So in Citizens United, you had a corporate group that made up its own ads and documentaries that were critical of Hillary Clinton, and they ran these ads close to an election in an obvious attempt to hurt Senator Clinton and to help her opponents. And what the Supreme Court said is just as individuals can expend their money independently any way they want, putting up billboards and taking out ads in favor of or against candidates, so too corporations can engage in independent expenditures, even though they can be limited in their contributions. Now, if Citizens United gets a lot of heat, and I hate the fact that money is so dominant in politics as much as anybody, but if Citizens United had come out the other way, if the Supreme Court had said government can prohibit corporations from engaging in their own expenditures on political purposes, then that could mean that the government could prohibit the New York Times from running a lot of editorials in favor of Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, because the New York Times is a corporation. And it's not easy to draw distinctions between different kinds of corporations. So a lot of people rail against Citizens United. But to be honest, most thoughtful First Amendment scholars don't see an easy way the court could have come out the other way.
Yeah, it's interesting. Thanks for providing that perspective. I think that's an interesting counterpoint to Citizens United that lots of folks do not think about. We're going to take a break. On the other side of this in 2 minutes, we're going to continue this conversation with Vic Amar, just looking at some other cases on the docket coming up for the U.S. Supreme Court. If you have questions about that, you can tweet to us. Our handle is 21STShow. Stay with us. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll continue this conversation just after this quick break. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. My guest is Vic Amar. He's a constitutional law scholar. He's also the dean of the University of Illinois College of Law. We're talking about the U.S. Supreme Court back in session as of last week, the first session with Neil Gorsuch, who replaced, of course, Justice Antonin Scalia. We've been talking about a case that originated right here in Illinois, Mark Janus versus AFSCME, about this whole concept of unions and who's paying. And that's one of the things that the court is going to be looking at. We asked some folks on Reddit about what questions they had about this court. Vic, I wanted to ask you about another case the court's going to be hearing. It's Gill versus Whitford, mm-hmm. the partisan gerrymandering case out of Illinois. The commenter said many people seem to predict this will lead to many states being districts being declared unconstitutional, or that it will essentially eliminate partisan gerrymandering as a possible challenge. Can you tell us a little bit about this case, Gill versus Whitford, and what's going on with that?
Sure. First, let's define partisan gerrymandering.
Great.
This is the practice that legislatures, especially state legislatures, engage in when one party that has a majority of the state legislature uses that power to redraw district lines to essentially pack voters of the opposing party into a relatively small number of districts so that, for example, if the Republicans have 55% of the electorate, they can control 70% of the districts. Because if you pack the Democrats into a small number of districts and you spread out the Republicans so that they're a bare majority in a large number of districts, you can leverage a small advantage in your voter membership to a larger advantage in the number of seats that you control in the legislature.
Right. Now, so named after Elbridge Gerry.
Right.
I played in fourth grade in the Constitutional Congress.
That's awesome.
Which is why I always remember everything about it.
So this has been going on, as you kind of intimate, for hundreds of years.
Right.
But with the advent of technology and big data, legislatures can do this ever more surgically and ever more effectively, so that legislatures can leverage small advantages they have in a state legislature into large number of seats that they win at the next election. And so the Supreme Court has had to decide whether there's any role for the judiciary in this mess. I think everybody agrees that you're never going to wring the politics out of drawing district lines. But everyone also has an instinct that, taken too far, this is un-American. This is not what democracy is about, using technology to entrench one party in power through the use of district drawing.
Right. So, and certainly we've seen this as a bipartisan issue. President Obama talked about this when he was in Springfield. Governor Rauner has said, I agree with President Obama that we need to be redrawing districts. This is something you hear from both parties.
It's not just Republicans who do it. Democrats do it when they have the advantage as well. A dozen or so years ago, the Republicans who controlled the Pennsylvania legislature engaged in pretty aggressive partisan gerrymandering, and it was challenged in the Supreme Court. And what the Supreme Court said back then was, we don't think there's an easy standard that the courts can use to step in and differentiate permissible partisan gerrymandering from excessive partisan gerrymandering. It's just there's no good line that can be drawn here, since there's always going to be some politics in this. And so we don't think courts should wade into this unless they have a good standard or a good baseline against which to judge any particular district. So that's where we've been for a dozen years. And now in this case out of Wisconsin, there are some legal scholars and others who think that they have devised a metric that would allow courts to police this activity a little bit more effectively. And it's anyone's guess what the Supreme Court's going to do. It could very well be that the justices say what they said 12 years ago, which is, we'd love to get rid of this practice when it's done in the extreme, but we don't see an easy way for courts to do it. You might draw an analogy to obscenity, where the court, is famous. One justice, Potter Stewart, is famous for having said, well, it's hard to define, but I know it when I see it. When the courts employ I know it when I see it tests, they lose credibility with the public. And so the court really doesn't want to wade into this area unless it has a firm test that can apply to differentiate between permissible and impermissible use of party considerations in drawing lines.
Right. Especially, I would imagine, in this atmosphere of so divided partisan politics. One last question for you, Vic. I know you've got to run, but obviously this is going to be a really, as I've alluded to, a really dense and jam-packed year as far as politics go. The Supreme Court starting to hear cases and pass down decisions. What are you looking at in terms of what you think will affect the already intense political climate that we're facing right now?
Well, we haven't talked about it, but we have some decisions that may issue involving President Trump's executive order regarding travel from certain countries. These cases were scheduled to be on the docket in October, but because this summer the president has revised some of these executive orders, we're not now sure what the court has to review and when it will review. But I think there's a good chance that some big executive order regarding international travel will make its way to the Supreme Court this term, and that's going to have huge implications depending on how it's resolved. My instinct is that the lower courts have been far less generous to the president in this regard than the law requires. Whether I think these travel orders make any policy sense or not, I think there are going to be at least five justices on the Supreme Court that will defer to the president in international affairs. And I think lower courts have kind of gotten ahead of themselves in not realizing what the standards that the Supreme Court have laid down are. But again, we'll have to see with the specifics when those cases get to the court.
Right. And then we can be back in that whole discussion again. Vic Amar is a constitutional law scholar. He's also dean of University of Illinois College of Law, joining us from our Urbana studios. Vic, always a pleasure to have you. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Nyla.
If you spent any time at the doctor's office or a hospital lately, you know it's often nurses who provide critical care. This is especially true when you consider the growing cost of health care and the long distances many people in rural communities have to travel to get care. There's a new state law that recognizes this by giving some nurses even more authority over the kind of care that they can provide without a doctor. These advanced practice nurses will now be able to prescribe and diagnose medications, including for patients with chronic conditions. There are roughly 12,000 APNs in Illinois. The bill passed both chambers by an overwhelming margin and was signed into law by Governor Rauner last month. Susan Swart is the executive director of the Illinois Society for Advanced Practice Nurses. She joins us on the line from Manteno. Also on the line is Christine Durbin. She's an associate professor at SIU Edwardsville School of Nursing. Susan, Christine, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you. Susan, let's start with you. I think unless you've been through the healthcare system recently in your work in it, it would be easy to lose track over all of the many qualifications and roles that different people have. Can we start by just explaining what is an advanced practice nurse and where are they in the spectrum of nursing, of the nursing profession?
So an advanced practice nurse by Illinois law is a registered nurse who has gone back to school for additional education, has received a graduate degree, minimum of a master's degree. Many of them also have doctorate degrees. And then they have to pass a national certification exam. And then once that certification exam is passed, then they can become licensed as advanced practice. And as of the signage from Governor Rauner, they are now referred to as advanced practice registered nurses, which is the language that's used throughout the nation. So Illinois just kind of decided that it was time for us to use the same language.
Now, I thought, Susan, nurses could already prescribe medications. What does this law change?
So they have. In Illinois, advanced practice registered nurses have been recognized. They were first licensed in 2001, and we have been working on perfecting the regulation for those individuals. They have been prescribing. What this particular law does is it removes the requirement then an advanced practice nurse has to have a formal written collaborative agreement with a physician in order to practice. So they continue to practice in the same way that they've been practicing since 2001, but now they no longer have to have that written agreement with a physician. They'll still refer when appropriate to their physician colleagues when it's outside of their expertise, but they won't have to have that agreement any longer.
That's Susan Swart. She's executive director of the Illinois Society for Advanced Practice Nurses. Christine Durbin's also with us. She's an associate professor at SIU Edwardsville School of Nursing. Christine, as we're listening to Susan talk about this new law, I imagine when we're thinking particularly about your part of the state, where I imagine nurses do play a critical role because there may not be as many doctors around. Is that correct?
Oh, that is correct. And the issue that Susan brought up about the written collaborative practice agreement was what would limit access to nurse practitioners providing health care in the rural areas of southern Illinois. Now that an advanced practice registered nurse does not need the written collaborative practice agreement, that means that the supervising physician does not have to be in contact in some shape or form so that the nurse can be functioning independently. This is a follow-up on the full practice authority that was described originally in the Institute of Medicine report earlier in 2000, and now is finally finding its practice acceptance in the state of Illinois.
Christine, can you give us the background on that report? I imagine that probably highlighted a lot of the challenges, particularly outside of our major cities, for healthcare and the role that nurses play.
Yeah, the Institute of Medicine analyzed healthcare in the United States and described the fact and elaborated on the fact that there is going to be massive shortages of healthcare providers, physicians, as well as nurses and advanced practice registered nurses throughout the country, and that in an effort to mitigate those shortages, and this is not just an aberrancy. There's not a virus going around. It's that there are fewer people going into the healthcare profession because there are fewer people of that age to do so. So they recommended, the Institute of Medicine recommended, that nurses who are advanced practice registered nurses practice to the fullest part of their authority, meaning let them do what they are trained to do, what they are educated to do. And in large part, that means relinquishing that tie with the written collaborative practice agreement. Now, the state of Illinois law limits this release from the written collaborative practice agreement only in licensed hospitals and in licensed ambulatory surgical centers. The nurse practitioner, the advanced practice registered nurse, cannot practice without a collaborative practice agreement in the outpatient settings where they may be in a physician's office, for example, or those kinds of things. There is still that limit that exists. However, this is a breakthrough, and the access points that are now more available for advanced practice registered nurses to be functioning in independently has expanded significantly.
Susan, as you're listening to Christine, I wonder if you can let us know, and as she's laid out very clearly for us, so this is clearly to free up hospitals and other large medical facilities where they may have a limited number of doctors, but also help nurses play a critical role in those areas. Where are we at in Illinois in terms of our shortage of doctors and nurses, particularly when we're thinking about outside of our biggest cities? Susan? Looks like we've lost Susan. Christine, I wonder if you could weigh in there.
Well, overall, what you're seeing is medical students go into healthcare and go into practice, fewer and fewer of physicians are going into primary care practice. And generationally, that is, we are facing fewer independent physician offices or doctor's practices. More often now, you're seeing physicians have nurse practitioners working in their offices. What we are seeing also is that as physicians go through their training, they are going into the hospitalist role, which is serving as a physician, a healthcare provider in the confines of the hospital. So you see that physician on admission to the hospital as opposed to seeing your own physician. And this is the role that you're seeing a lot more of the physicians go into, or into specialization. So the people who see patients who are sick on the front line more often are going to be the advanced practice registered nurses and the working in the doctor's offices or now in urgent cares or in the emergency departments of hospitals or in ambulatory surgical centers. So advanced practice nurses are sort of filling the gap, if you will.
Right. And it also sounds like then, does it sound like from a practical matter, maybe less wait times at an emergency room or an urgent care facility or something like that because you have more staff that's able to fill in? Is that also part of
the goal. Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that is the goal, because if you don't have to be tied to this written collaborative practice agreement, which means that a supervising physician has to be fairly closely affiliated or on site, that does free up that personnel piece that has been plaguing the whole written collaborative practice agreement issue.
Right. We're going to take a break. If you guys can stick around for just a few more minutes, we're speaking with Christine Durbin from SAIU Edwardsville and Susan Swart from Illinois Society of Advanced Practice Nurses about this new change. Stay tuned. We'll pick up this conversation on the other side of the break. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
I'm Nyla Boodoo, and you're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're talking about a new law that will especially help with rural health care. It just was signed into law by Governor Rauner last month. It regards advanced practice registered nurses, now able to prescribe and diagnose medications, including for patients with chronic conditions, without necessarily being tied to doctors. We've been hearing a little bit more about this with Christine Durbin. She's an associate professor at SIU Edwardsville, where she's in the School of Nursing, and Susan Swart, who's executive director of the Illinois Society for Advanced Practice Nurses. Susan, do you have to change your name now to Advanced Practice Registered Nurses, since now that's the new title in Illinois?
That's always we've had that question many times. No, we will not be. Actually, our title of our organization is Advanced Practice Nursing, and so it focuses more on the practice and not the official title.
Okay, good. And yes. for all of us who are not in the healthcare industry, we will still know these nurses as APNs, correct? That's kind of the title that they'll go by. That's how we'll know who they are.
They actually, their title will switch to advanced practice. So APRN.
Ah, so APRN will be kind of the lingo that everyone will be using.
Right.
Susan, where does this law put Illinois compared to other states? Do most other states have laws like this on the books that free
well,
up?
Illinois, yeah. Mm-hmm. Illinois is the 26th state who has adopted this kind of language. And so there are many more states that pretty much every year, states have been doing this. Missouri has tried multiple times, just like Illinois did, in order to get this recognition. Most states have advanced practice nurses recognized. The issue is how many barriers might be in that practice law that ties them unnecessarily to physicians or other requirements. And so the law that we have is full practice authority, and we're the 26th state to adopt it.
And Christine, where do you think we're at with Illinois? How do we compare to other states in terms of having laws that allow nurses to do their best work for patients? Do you think we have more to go here?
Oh, I do think so. I think that the size of the state and the educational resources that the state has, plus the very many teaching hospitals and training ground, if you will, for advanced practice nurses, demands that we pay more attention to adhering to the IOM's call to get nurses, advanced practice nurses, to practicing within their full practice authority. I think this is a very good step, and I'm very encouraged by it. I think the needs for mental health care, the needs for midwifery care, is now going to just really be advanced so that people can have access to the care they need by the fact of these advanced practice registered nurses being more available. There is an issue, I think, for our colleagues in the nurse anesthesia areas where they still must practice with an anesthesiologist or dentist or I think podiatrist. I can't remember all the parts in the law, but they have to have a supervising.
Right, makes sense given the role it makes sense given the role of anesthesiology I understand there would probably be a little bit more pushback with that. But as it sounds like you've said, perhaps maybe lots more room for this to expand into midwifery or mental health practices. I want to thank Christine Durbin. Thanks for being with me, Associate Professor at Southern Illinois University Edwardsville in the School of Nursing, and Susan Swart, Executive Director of the Illinois Society for Advanced Practice Nursing. Thank you for being with me both.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Rizzo hits a little pop fly, shallow left center. Turner going out. That ball is going to be a base hit. Coming in to score is Martin. The Cubs take the lead. The Cubs take the lead.
Pat Hughes, 670, the score last night, calling what would be the winning run there for the Chicago Cubs. Now, this afternoon could be the day that they clinch the division series title. Two steps away now from going back to the World Series. This series really right now, 2-1 in the National League division against the Washington Nationals. Lots going on in the world of Chicago sports. The NBA season kicks off a week from today. The Chicago Bulls are in full rebuilding mode, let's say, after trading away Jimmy Butler and buying out Dwayne Wade. And of course, it's football season. The Bears lost last night against the Minnesota Vikings. I guess we could call this a mixed debut for rookie quarterback Mitch Trubisky. There's also, of course, lots of conversation that continues around kneeling during the national anthem that are looming over the league. Joining us now to talk about all of these issues is WB Chicago sports contributor Cheryl Reistout, who has been running from Wrigley to Soldier Field and back over the past yesterday. Hey, Cheryl, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us. Cheryl?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. So let's start with baseball. Cubs hoping to go back-to-back. No team in baseball has done this since the 2000 New York Yankees. Nationals home this afternoon. Jake Arrieta is right on the mound. What do chances look like for winning tonight, Cheryl?
The difficulty is because the weather is going to be a factor. They're talking about rain, so you want to get Jake Arrieta on the mound. But if it's a stop and start, it may be one of those difficult long evenings. So baseball has to figure out whether they want to get this game in or wait till tomorrow. But right now, it's a go. And Jake Arrieta, who is still coming back from a hamstring injury, we don't know what we're going to get from him on the mound tonight.
You know, Cheryl, I'm not living too far from Wrigley Field these days, and I was watching the game last night with another friend from the neighborhood who was saying that she didn't feel like there's a level of excitement that there was last year. And I'm kind of curious about that. I think last year everybody was so excited about the idea of breaking the curse. It had been so long. What do you think fan energy is like around this series?
Your friend hit it right on the head. It is like that. It's like the fans are just waiting for something to happen for them to be excited. This happens anytime a team wins, especially for a team that hasn't won for so long. But to say
we're so
that
fickle,
excited,
huh?
well, you know what it is? It's like, and I think everyone's fatigued too. But what was interesting is when Anthony Rizzo dropped that ball into the outfield for the game-winning RBI, it was so loud that the Washington Nationals outfielders could not hear each other.
I could hear it. I could hear it at that point. And I live a couple – yeah, I could hear it at that point. I just muted my TV, and I could hear everybody screaming at Wrigley. So I'll tell you, that was the moment I could hear everything.
Yeah, and so they know how to rise to the occasion. It's just that they are taking the been there, done that, okay, wait for more.
Right. So if the Cubs win, are you ready to talk about that? Should we talk about that?
Sure.
Okay, likely they're going to face the Dodgers, right? Who can sweep Arizona tonight?
They would face the Dodgers on Saturday, yes.
Mm-hmm. So the L.A. Dodgers, what are their chances?
Well, this is a difficult challenge because the Dodgers blew through the Arizona Diamondbacks to get to this point, and they have revenge on their mind for last year with the Cubs. But I'm telling you, Nyla, the way the Cubs, their starting pitching has just been outstanding. And starting pitching, if you have it, and they were facing great starting pitching too, the Washington Nationals. So it's been an interesting duel on the mound, and if the Cubs can carry that over to the Dodgers, it's going to be a long seven-game series, and the Cubs could win that.
Let's switch to football for a minute, Cheryl, and the Bears. I have to say, I was kind of laughing when the game was introduced last night because the way ESPN introduced Mitch Trubisky was the franchise that's been looking for a leader for a quarter of a century or something along those lines in terms of their – and I was like, that's a lot to put on this kid. Let's talk about how the game went last night.
Well, he was good. He was not so good, and then he was just okay. You know, it was uneven. He showed a lot of mobility. He has a terrific arm. He did have a drive at the end of the game to win it. I mean, to score a touchdown to tie it, and the 2-point conversion was fun to see. However, he made a big mistake with the interception. He admitted after the game.
Yeah, that was tough to watch.
Ball.
I saw that. I thought, oh, yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that he took it on himself. He does have a lot of great qualities, Nyla. He can run, which, you know, that's a real need. But he also can pass while he's running, which is a really tough ability to do. And he has it. However, this Bear team has no skilled wide receivers. So
who he's going to throw the ball to is essentially what you're saying, Cheryl?
The tight ends. The tight ends are the ones that's who caught the touchdown. Those are the ones that are going to have to make the plays for him. So if they don't fix that, he's not going to have great success. Also, the offensive line still got some injury issues, so he's going to scramble a lot. But what he has to do is not make mistakes. What he has to do is start learning how to read defenses better. And I think when you put that all together, he will be okay, but he's not going to be a winner right off the bat.
Well, yeah, it's tough to be. Should we just suffice to say it's tough to be a Bears fan and leave it at that?
Oh, yeah. Talk to my husband with the season ticket holder. You don't want to talk to him today.
Cheryl, let me ask you, can we go to sort of the whole controversy, the political controversy around the NFL? I was surprised last night that ESPN didn't show the national anthem, but I wasn't sure if it was because they wanted to play commercials, which has been, you know, kind of a standard thing, or avoid controversy, especially since it was hours after ESPN host Jemele Hill was suspended after her tweets around this issue. Can you give us some background on that? First of all, that situation with her being suspended and what kind of the talk has been around that?
Yeah, it's been very divided about Jemele. She had originally wrote some tweets about Donald Trump that didn't get her suspended, but, you know, it caught the attention of the president and a lot of people.
Calling him a white supremacist, we should say. Right.
Mm-hmm. But what happened last weekend is that all the national anthems were shown, but they decided this week the networks not to show it.
Ah, so what all the networks made that decision. Okay.
Right.
I see.
What has happened in between is that ownership, like Jerry Jones from the Dallas Cowboys, has said that if any player that kneels or, you know, is not there for the national anthem, they could be fired. They could be replaced. So Jemele Hill, what she did, she tweeted out, well, you know what, if you want to get to Jerry Jones, you know, for the people that don't want to agree with Jerry Jones, is to go after his advertisers.
I thought it was very carefully worded. She did say, mm-hmm. if you support this, the way to do this is to boycott. She was suspended. I'm curious, Cheryl, I've seen a lot of sports journalists expressing political opinions these days. And I'm just curious, for someone, you've been in the industry for some time, how do you think ESPN's handling this? This is a tough thing.
ESPN is just, they don't know what they're doing anymore. It is a network that's in disarray as far as I see it. And they're caught between a rock, because they are losing subscribers left and right. People are cutting the cord, and so ESPN is losing that. So they don't. I think that there's a lot of mismanagement going on there. That's just my opinion from watching them from afar. They want to have titillating, entertaining hosts. But yet they want to squelch when somebody has an opinion. And you can't do that. You can't have it both ways.
Right. And then it also, of course, the fact that it was a black woman who was suspended
yes.
is also something that lots of folks have been commenting on. So I'm sure that conversation is going to continue. I've seen a lot of conversation on social media. I know youth, all sports journalists are all talking about it as well. We'll have to have a longer conversation about that. And we didn't even get to the Bulls, but that's okay because we have a week for that. So we'll have to have you come back and give us a preview of the Bulls and the NBA. WBEZ's Cheryl Reisout, very busy in this Cubs playoff season. Thanks for taking the time.
Anytime for you, Nyla.
Thanks, Cheryl. That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for the 21st. All of those links, directions for finding us on Alexa, iTunes, or Android are all at our website, 21stshow.org. You can also follow us on Twitter. Search for 21stshow. We're produced by Alan Montesilio, Bob Holly, and Robin Lynn. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive director. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Broadcasting today from the Medill School of Graduate Journalism in downtown Chicago, I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.